RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Portland.
This is your community-supported radio station, KBOO Portland. Before we get going with our programming, I want to remind everyone that you can donate today at kbu.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Again, that's kbu.fm/give. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Thank you.
Yeah, what's really going on? This is Boost from the Coup with Hard Knock Radio. You gotta be there.
What up, y'all? It's Aya Sage, a.k.a. Rocky Rivera, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop.
David D., Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We're sitting here, the chairman, Omali Eshetelli, and in case you don't know him, listen to Dead Prez's album, and you hear his voice on the first song, you know, talking about the wolf, you know, licking the sword because he's so hungry. But many of us know him for the work that they've been doing for the past 30, 40 years in terms of liberation. And we wanted to talk to him since he's in town. Let me start off with you with a quick question, because I want to talk to you about Huey Newton and what he meant and why, and your assessment of the country. But you are also based in Florida, St. Petersburg, and we can't talk to you with you being here from Florida without talking about the recent carnage that took place, 17 students killed at a high school. But this is the same state that we saw 50 people get killed at a nightclub. This is the same place that we saw the tragedy around Trayvon Martin. What is going on in Florida? I mean, there's a lot of things that seem to constantly be going on in the Sunshine State that are increasingly becoming spark points for a number of conversation, if not movements.
Well, it's the same state also that on March 31st, 2016, the Pinellas County Sheriff Department ran by car into a lake of 215 and 116-year-old girls and pushed them into a lake and drowned them in a cemetery and blamed the girls for being bad girls and coming from bad families. And they've declared in that county that the headquarters of all the car thefts in the state of Florida is right there in that county. And they claim the three girls had stolen a car, which has never been the case. They say that even today. So Florida, I mean, you know, the Trayvon Martin and the other instances that you've just mentioned, Orlando, what just happened down in South Florida with the 17 people being killed, those are realities. And
it's saying that, you know, white supremacist organizations are taking claims, saying that he was a member, and now the authorities are trying to say, no, they can't find no evidence, but... Mm-hmm. I bring this up because also in Orlando, a couple of years ago, they discovered there were some police officers that were connected to the Ku Klux Klan, and mm-hmm. they were serving, you know, on the force there. So this seems to be a spark plug state.
Well, it's also the state that the African People's Socialist Party was born in. And so it's simply to state that the contradictions do get relatively sharp there. And we see happening sometimes in Florida breakout situations. Like, nobody could explain, for example, why did the Black Panther Party start in Oakland, California? I mean, in many ways, Oakland was put on the map for people around the world because of the Panther Party and the resistance that developed here. Somebody interviewed me many years ago during the same era of the Panthers, where we had created an organization called JOMO, and asked me, how do you explain this? Here in St. Petersburg, Florida, of all places, why would it come from here? Why would it come from Oakland? And I think in both instances, what we're looking at is where contradictions are sharpest, where you see coming together various kinds of contradictions. In Oakland, of course, you know, we built, that is to say, Africans built a ship a day for Kaiser during the Second Imperialist War. We were brought here in the most difficult circumstances, and they brought in they brought in white cops from the South to keep this Black community controlled, who were being used, that was being used to create wealth and build the economy here. Florida, St. Petersburg, Florida, you had a similar situation. In fact, in many ways, Florida is different from most of the South in that it's you see many people who are in Florida, not born in Florida, they've come from the North and what have you and settled there. And one would think that they would be different if the narrative about how the South was so bad, the North was so good. But you see Florida, where you still have a right to work laws so that there's no ability for unions to go on strike or to require others to join a union in a particular shop. And yet, most of the white people who live there, who are in authority, have come from places where unions were very strong. And this is not just people in authority. These are just ordinary white people, but they're anti-union and anti all the things that they were for in other places they've come from. So
why is that? Is that because they see benefits, people of color benefiting from that, and so that kind of trumps their thinking, or is there something else in play?
Well, I think that part of what's happening is that in this country, you have a situation where the whole capitalist economy was born and came as a consequence of things being taken from the indigenous people, the Mexicans in California, from Africans, period. And all the wealth, including that of the workers, come from this relationship. There was no working class under feudalism, and white people lived under feudal domination when we first met them. They were liberated by the advent of capitalism that destroyed us, that took us into slavery and all kinds of bad contradictions. So you see then when we are moving toward advancing our own interests, there's an assumption that it's coming at the expense of the interests of the white people who've always dominated. So that's a fundamental kind of contradiction. And I think in Florida, I do think you see that very sharply. You know, you've got a large Cuban base that's there. You've also got a lot of Mexicans there, as quiet as it's kept, in Florida.
An increasing amount of Puerto Ricans as well, especially after this hurricane.
Exactly. And then you've got the Africans who are there. So I can't say exactly why these things happen in Florida, but I can say that much of what this reveals, notwithstanding what I think may very well be some right-wingers or reactionaries trying to grab on and take responsibility for what happened so that they can get Bill themselves. But I think that what is clear is that something is very broken in this whole social system. Because you're talking about, a 19-year-old kid? How old was he? 19 years old?
Yeah.
Who kills 17 children? You're talking about Las Vegas, where a guy comes and kills 58 people. And
shoots 500.
Yeah. And they want to blame it on a bump stock, or they want to blame it on the availability of guns, and all of those are factors in terms of how it happened, but why it happened. What is going on? What is wrong? And they cannot critique the society itself. They cannot criticize the society, so they end up criticizing people who commit certain kinds of acts that disrupt things. Whether it's somebody who shoots and kills 58 people or 17 people, or whether it's a black person with a beret on that says, we ain't taking it no more, anything that disrupts the process, and you've got a whole bunch of disruption. You've got a whole social system that is in a state of severe crisis. If not just here, look at what's happening throughout Europe and other places around the world, and look at what's happening outside of Europe and outside of this country, and some inside this country, and you'll see what's going on. And what's going on is that the whole capitalist system is a parasite, and it was born through parasitism, through slavery and colonialism. And every place you look in the world, people are breaking free. So you've got perennial warfare that's happening in the Middle East. You've got in Afghanistan, where people are so poor that they cannot even afford bread for their children. They've been fighting now for 16, 17 years against the most powerful country in the world, and there's no end in sight. The U.S. cannot defeat them, one, and then secondly, the fact is, if it's not Afghanistan, it's Venezuela, it's this place, that place, that, and it's going to be like that forever because people want to be free. And what happens is, in this country, in the United States, in Europe, this struggles for freedom means that there are less resources now being going to the empire, to the imperialists, and then so you see fights generated between the imperialist forces themselves, Trump, and all the people that he's having to fight with. These are sectors of the bourgeoisie. Trump is not a worker. Trump is not some beret-wearing revolutionary who's come there. He's part of the bourgeoisie himself, and you see this internecine warfare going on between sectors of the bourgeoisie in this country, and then it's happening in Europe. You got Brexit that's happening. I mean, the whole thing is falling apart, and then you see tremendous amount of anxiety in a white population that's accustomed to everything going smoothly. And
when we say smoothly, we're talking about accustomed to having people get run over
exactly. Without
too much resistance.
Exactly.
And now they're seeing people ain't taking it.
Exactly.
And so now we're seeing all the pushback. Let me ask you this. We're talking with Chairman Amalia Ashitele, if you're just tuning in, from the Uhuru movement. I brought up Florida for one reason, I said, because it seems to also spark off a lot of movement. So one could argue, you know, out of Trayvon Martin, we had the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, as one thing. With this latest killing, we're seeing the conversation come up about gun control. And we see an automatic reaction. Yes, we got to have gun control. And we're looking at this president who said, you know, who took away protections to say that anybody who had documented mental issues can't get a gun. This guy was documented, you know, had mental issues. He was able to get a gun because Trump had repealed, you know, the laws that would have prevented him from doing that. But as we have this move for gun control, what does that mean for black people, especially black people who are oppressed and black people who are looking for liberation? Do we get on that gun control thing, or do we hold on to ourselves? And, you know, how do we engage this?
I would remind people who today have some kind of romantic notion about the Black Panther Party is that the reason the Panthers went into Sacramento and invaded that state legislature was around the issue of gun control. When the state was talking about trying to make it impossible for people to carry their weapons, and the Panthers at the demonstration went there, and they went there because it was clear to us, particularly during this era, defenseless. This is what they're asking and demanding, that black people be defenseless. One. Secondly, there is gun control. That's why there are 850,000 stops by cops, stops and frisks. That's why they in New York alone, at a particular period, that's why every community that we live in, there's consistent stopping black people, especially young black men, searching black men, make sure that we're unarmed. That's why you can go to certain cities and you see billboards up saying, turn in your guns and we'll give you a bag of groceries or $50 or something to that effect. There is gun control, but it's directed specifically at us, and it's directed at us because they do require a defenseless black community. So that's the concern that we have to have and we should have. And no, we do not believe in gun control. We believe in police gun control. We believe in Ferguson. After the murder of Mike Brown and the rebellion that happened there, the guns in St. Louis, Ferguson area, all the guns, ammunition, were bought up by whom? White people bought all the guns there. And yet the FBI comes in, frames up three black people and put them in jail, ostensibly for wanting to commit some kind of offense that the FBI itself had created. So the idea of gun control is a very serious question for us. What our problem is that we do not organize the Africans in our community, one who got some, they think they got guns, but when it comes to what the state's got, they got nothing. You understand? And our problem is that mayhem happens in our community because we live under colonial domination. And under colonial domination, the oppressor does everything it wants to do. If there's a gun in your community, it's the oppressor wants it in your community. If there's drugs in your community, the oppressor wants it in your community. They don't want jobs, they don't want health care, they don't want any other things that we need. So this issue, this notion that somehow that we should be for gun control because this kid shot 17 kids and killed 17 kids, I should say, is insidious, and it's used against us.
Is it a smarter way to look at this, instead of gun control, is mutual disarmament, you know, meaning if I give in my gun, then maybe the police need to take away some of their weaponry, maybe law enforcement need to take away some of their weaponry. It's always been my contention that as we collectively disarm ourselves or told that we need to disarm ourselves, there's an entire population and an apparatus that supports it that is heavily armed, and there's no conversation about, okay, I gave it my gun, what about this police department that has a tank and has all this surplus, you know, armament that is routinely used against a population that is increasingly defenseless?
Well, if it's routinely used, it can't be surplus, can it? I mean, this is the thing that's tricky. Like we saw with Ferguson, and for many people, it was the first time they saw the police come with the real armament that they have, right? And they said, well, it's a police program that they give surplus weapons to these cities. But if it's surplus, and this has been going on now for at least since the 80s, how can you still call it surplus? It's part of the Pentagon budget that puts these arms throughout the country to control African people in the event that we rise up. That's why they were able in Dallas the brother Michael X. Johnson, to get him, they just went to the office and got a robot with some C4 explosive to kill him. So this is in the police department where you're located. The thing is that you cannot have mutual disarmament because there is a thing called the state. And the state is an institution of coercion. That's absolutely necessary when you have societies that are split between haves and have-nots, and those who have get it as a consequence of taking it from those who don't have. The state is an absolute necessity if you've got a colonized population. If you look at what happens in African people, I'm tired of people talking about racism. I don't give a damn about racism. That's about whether somebody likes us or not like us. The question is power. They've got the power. You talked earlier about something about the movie Black Panther, and this debate is going on about whether you should have power or something to that effect. And, of course, you have to have power. You have to first neutralize the power of the oppressor. When we talk about the police, we're not just talking about some people with guns. We're talking about an organized force, the existence of which is to maintain the status quo. And if you have a status quo of oppression and oppressed, that's what the police are there for. They are not there. So you cannot get rid of the police as long as you have that relationship. How do you end that relationship? Is you have to destroy the ability of the oppressor state to impact in your life. The real struggle for democracy for a colonized people is to neutralize the state, the colonial state.
But how do you do that? Is that with arms? Is that with the vote? Or is that, you know, how does that happen? Because you use words that mean different things to different people. When you say neutralize, somebody's going, get a gun. Mm-hmm. You say neutralize, somebody says vote him out of office. Somebody else is saying go down there and take it to the streets. What does that mean? You know, march around and maybe you can, you know, convince them to leave, you know, voluntarily. So what exactly?
I'm going to tell you this. I don't mean Black Lives Matter and hands up, don't shoot. I don't mean an event. I'm talking about revolution. And revolution is not an event, it's a process. And it's led. You know, there's revolutionary leadership, and it has to be able to wage struggle using every form of struggle. That means it has a strategic approach that can employ things like the electoral process. Like we've just ran a campaign in St. Petersburg, Florida, under the slogan Unity Through Reparations. Now, St. Petersburg, Florida, only 23% of the population is African in St. Petersburg, Florida, but we had a couple of hundred people marching down the street demanding reparations to Black people. And I'm saying that that's a part of a revolutionary process that deals with the consciousness and the activity, and we invade that space that's supposed to be their space exclusively.
Somebody listening to this would say, that is so wrong, you shouldn't be voting. We shouldn't be voting, shouldn't participate in the system. How do you respond to that notion?
Well, I mean, I think that you shouldn't be voting if you think voting is the way to be freedom. That's not vote. You don't vote. You vote and participate in the electoral process as an organized force with certain kinds of objectives to undermine the social system itself. So we invade that system to undermine the process, because the process cannot handle Black people and other people saying reparations to Black people. Go on, let's vote on reparations. Let's have a debate. Let's have this on a regular basis through the electoral process, just like you debate the questions of what's going to happen to sewage and how much taxes are going to go to
safety net programs.
Yeah. This becomes a part of the discourse that the system cannot tolerate that. They had a situation where they actually banned us from participating in the only televised debate for the mayor. You saw a part of a debate here when this white man in St. Petersburg, Florida, said, reparations, you got your reparations with the election of Obama. And if you want more or something to that effect, go back to Africa.
I remember that. They showed that, but they didn't show the other side of that.
They didn't show the other side. And see, this is what I'm talking about. And this is, they can't tolerate, they can't handle that. It brings out the very essence of the system itself.
So what happened on the other side? We saw that, and everybody was outraged, but this was a result of the campaign that
you
pushed that for.
This guy was sitting up on a panel with a white guy that we were running for mayor under the slogan of Unity Through Reparations. And this is his response to that. That was his response to our guy when he said that. And we've organized an organization called Community United for Reparations and Economic Development to the Black Community, CURED. And this is comprised of Africans and white people who are fighting for reparations and economic development, and use the electoral process as the means by which to do this. Now, this generates all kinds of stuff. It affects the consciousness of people, and yes, some people may say it's time to lock and load. Well, that's a part of the process of the whole thing becoming to degenerate. You don't just run out and do stuff. You create conditions that make other things possible.
Let me ask you this. We're talking with Chairman Omali Ishiteli of the Uhuru Movement, the Uhuru House. That's where we're at right now. You mentioned that you talked about racism, and what immediately came to mind when you were talking about Ferguson and the tanks and all that was one of the reasons the tanks were there was earlier, 4 months prior to the Ferguson rebellion, there was an amendment that came out of Florida. You know, Alan Grayson, congressman out of Florida, again, put an amendment on a bill in June of 2014 that said it would strip the police of being able to get these quote-unquote surplus things. That was an amendment that he had added. And it was the Congressional Black Caucus. Every last one of them except seven.
Yes.
You know, so Barbara Lee was against it. Maxine Waters was against it. Keith Ellingson was against it. It was a guy out of Georgia that was against it. But everybody else went along. There's two other people, but right. I remember because right. I put all their pictures up there, right. you know. They all went gung-ho and voted down that amendment.
Yes.
You had the sister that was in Milwaukee. I mean, she really carried the water
yes,
and
did.
Talked about how dare Alan Grayson, blah, blah, blah. And so what was crazy was 4 months later, we saw these tanks come out. And then it was interesting to see at the funeral Congressman Lacey Clay out of St. Louis, the other guy, Cleaver,
yeah.
out of Missouri,
yeah.
sitting at the funeral talking yeah. about we need to get rid of these tanks, but they were the ones that voted down the amendment that came out of Florida that would have resisted. So I bring all this up to say, what happens when we have these black faces who are popular because they're visible, they're popular because they seem culturally in tune with the community, but their politics, you know, it's very confusing.
Yeah, they wear dashiki sometimes on Black History Month, and they know the same dances we know. Sometimes they go to the same churches and whatever that we go to. But this is what I would remind people of, is that we had an incredible revolutionary movement in this country in the 1960s. I'm mentioning sixes, not to wax nostalgia, but something happened, and I want to talk about that. First of all, what happened is that we won the Civil Rights Bill, 1964, the Voting Rights Act, 1965. At the same time, what the United States government was doing was killing Malcolm, killing Martin Luther King, 68, destroying the Black Panther Party, destroying every revolutionary entity that was in our community, or neutralizing much of it. Then this is the context under which you get the right to vote. They've destroyed the program, that the 10-point program is there with the Panthers. The Malcolm X, the Ballad of the Bullet is out of the way. The question of poor people's rights, that Martin Luther King, that's out of the way. We no longer have independent organizations, independent programs of our own. So what do we have? The Democratic Party. And its program is not the 10-point program. It is not the Ballad of the Bullet. And so And then you have a neo-colonial situation that's imposed on us after they moved the revolutionary organizations, revolutionary personalities, and every one of those Negroes, bar none, I don't care about the seven who did vote against it, bar none, function as a neo-colonial entity because there is nothing in the community, no real revolutionary organization that informs the politic in this country because the government kills it. And right now, this government is talking about black identity extremists. So somebody who says that you got to fight for black people, for black rights, for Africans, et cetera, are characterized as domestic terrorists. So now when you see people involved in the electoral process, they're Democrats, and they're Democrats who are denouncing black power, black Panthers, and their basic public policy is police containment, just like the white people, police containment, as opposed to economic development for black people. They can't even say black. Obama did not say black when he ran for office, except when he denounced black people at Father's Day in Chicago, if you remember that. So this is the kind of contradiction you've got. So it turned a lot of black people off against electoral politics because they never did nothing for us. They killed the ones, destroyed the organization that tried to do something for us. Now what we're doing is we're taking a 10-point program, we're taking Ballad of the Bullet. We are taking a basic program that came out of our work with the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice. We're taking that into the electoral arena. So here is a 19-point platform, a national black agenda for self-determination, not for integration, but self-determination. Put this on the ballot. And we're demanding that every African running for office, in fact, we have an electoral school, second one, coming up on April 7th and 8th in St. Louis. That's going to be happening now to teach people how to run for office. And this is the platform, and this is the approach you should have, and that there's nothing biblical about an election.
You're talking about this publicly. Somebody's listening. You don't think that the power structure that controls the ballot boxes and computers and all these different things that determine an election is not going to make a counter move or try to run somebody who sounds... uses the same rhetoric as you. but then we'll still have the neo-colonial situation. We were talking off air about Obama that, yes, he listens to JV, and that you know, and as you said, the Congress people will wear the dashikis, but then they may support school privatization.
Yes.
You know, we're talking about Betsy DeVoe and forgetting about Arne Duncan,
yes,
right, you know, who was in the previous administration who was just as bad, you know, maybe in a different context, but pretty bad, or as we said, all the Congress people that voted to arm the police with these military tanks that they then used against folks, or even the premise for black identity extremists was enhanced under Obama when he signed into law that order that allowed the whole state to be a battlefield or something like that. I'm gonna remember that. So it kind of sets it up so when somebody puts different words to it, then all of a sudden everybody's suspect, even if you're not near the scene of any sort of action.
Yeah, of course they will counter it. And the only way that we have to really deal with this is to do what none of them is willing to do, and that's to go into the depths of our community and organize the base. I'm talking about the same people who the Panthers had going door-to-door in the housing projects, doing sickle cell anemia testing, that was organizing there. That's the weapon. That's the tool. And they're not going to do that. No matter how much BS they talk, no matter how fancy they are, smooth-talking they are, if we are willing to go to the roots of our community and mobilize that force, that's the force that terrorizes them. That's the force that they're stopping and frisking. That's the force that they want to do things with because they're sagging and what have you. We go there. Build our base there. And that's the key thing. Yeah, they're going to do stuff, but we will dismiss them because we're going to run the saggers for office. We're going to have a real army of people, organized African workers and poor people. That's going to be the key, because that's the thing that's been missing, and that's the reason why there are something like one out of every eight persons in prison in the world is an African in this country, because they want to make sure that force is not tapped into.
I want to talk about Huey, but let me ask you one last question before we talk about Huey, because it's his birthday this weekend. A fault line is celebrityism, pop culture, people who we see on TV, you know, who have visibility. How does their pull, collectively speaking, how does that compare to the organizing that you have to do? Because one of the things would be is to find somebody who's really popular, you know, maybe a Lil Wayne or, you know, or if we did JV and others, and they are, to come out and tell people to do what you're saying, but then direct them in another way.
Well,
how does that count? Because they, in theory, because of their product that is digested day in and day out, they are in the community. They are in people's homes. They are in the cars, you know, because you consume them in all these ways. And now as you're consuming them, they're saying, yeah, vote, but vote for Hillary.
Yeah.
Or, you know, organize, but organize around school privatization.
They even use the parents of people who've been murdered by the police to have them to come out and do you know, promos for Hillary Clinton, what have you. You saw that happen just recently. So the thing is that I would remind people that when the Bolshevik Revolution happened, the majority of the people in Russia didn't even know what Lenin looked like. He marched in demonstrations, and it's really interesting. He marched in demonstrations where people under the kinds of influences that you were talking about were so upset because stance that the Bolsheviks and Lenin had taken. They were saying, where is this Lenin? Because we want to do something bad to him. And he's marching out there with him. They didn't even know how he looked. So the question is, critical question is organization. And that's what's been sacrificed. That's what, when the government came for us, they destroyed our organizations in the communities, and they've been putting pressures on those communities since that time. And so that's the critical question. Secondly, if you remember, the Black Panther Party and all of us had this issue because the government had begun to put forth this blaxploitation. They began to romanticize pimps and hustlers and things like that in our community. This was a part of the ideological warfare that was being made against our community. That's one of the reasons that the Panthers had to come out, you know, with swag, with the berets and all this other kind of stuff, because they got to compete. And we understood this in the 60s, that we had to create a competing image in our own communities to take it from the pimps, to take it from the hustlers and stuff like that, but still have swag that the people wanted to identify with. So the thing that you're talking
talking about is the absolute need for a revolutionary force to be able to connect really with this community and with the essence of the community and to win that community, because the community don't come to us.
Right. So it sounds like what you're talking about, the fault line is culture as it's always been.
It has always been.
And who can control the cultural narrative.
And also a better definition of culture, because culture is not just dancing and singing and stuff like that. It's the essence of who we are as a people. And if you can preach us, play on that, you know, really effectively. And they don't even, sometimes, I almost said they don't do the stuff that Jay-Z, but sometimes they do it better than Jay-Z. But I'm saying that to be really rooted and tap into our community. And if you can't do that, if you're not doing that, you don't need the damn power. You don't deserve it anyway. Because that's the critical question, winning our community and not conceding our community to the Jay-Z's or Lil Wayne's or anything else. Go to that community, because that community suffers. And this suffering is not ended with singing and dancing. You may ameliorate it for a while. You may take the minds off for a while, just like reefer and stuff like that might give you a sense of well-being. But when the high is over, you still got the same problem.
But money is also coming into the community. You know, you hear people like they bought the housing projects or they're sending people to college. So there is economic gifting that's coming, not to the entire community, mm-hmm. but enough of that people can say, send me to school. You know, he paid my rent. You know, he gave me turkey. I mean, some people may find it funny, but that goes a long way.
It does go a long way, and it's not funny. In many ways, it's ridiculous, because that is not people, and that is how media can affect consciousness, how they can show this one person who got the turkey, or five people, or 20 people got the turkey, and it becomes a substitute for the poverty of everybody else. Not only does that happen, but it gives the 80 people who didn't get anything something to aspire to be one of the 20 who will get something, and so that sometimes takes them out of the mix as well.
So you start getting mad at the artist for not giving you a turkey versus the government that made you poor so you can't buy one yourself.
Well, that's part of what happens, and the thing is, like, right now we're involved in a project called Black Power Blueprint in St. Louis, and I don't know how familiar you are with the circumstances, situation in St. Louis, but it is, you know, perhaps 50% African. They say 47%, but it's probably 50% African. They are something like 28 wards in St. Louis. Only 8 of them have African alderpersons. I mean, 28 wards, only 8 with African alderpersons. There's an extraordinary deterioration that happens in North St. Louis, where African people live. Housing stock collapsing, everything just bad, 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 and that's all you hear on the radio, crime, you know, mayhem. But we're in there. And we have initiated this project. We've taken a 9,000-square-foot building. We have an Uhura House there now, 3-story building, placed in this community on a real thoroughfare, and transformed this thing. You should go there. Look for Black Power Blueprint. Everybody, look for Black Power Blueprint on your internet, and you'll see this incredible job. We have brigades coming from around the country coming in and fixing that place up, transforming that community. We've got another property that we're initiating a company that an Uhura restaurant and cafe and bakery, where we also put in a workforce program that people, especially felons, can come learn how to cook and do this kind of stuff and get training. We've opening community event spaces, gardens, and stuff like that. That's in the north side. It's the worst part of St. Louis, they say. When I tell people I bought a house in St. Louis, they say, where? I say, tell them where it is. They say, oh, you're really in the hood, and I hope you got guns. Well, everybody in St. Louis got a gun.
Right.
But the thing is that we are there, and the community is participating in transforming that community, because we are there. We're not trying to do it from some other place. We are there among the people. We're in the neighborhood association meetings, and people in the neighborhood association meeting, talking about black power, about achieving power, although the black elected officials are not doing that, and they have a real problem with us because they see us as a threat to their presumed hegemony. Now, Soros, a billionaire, brought all kinds of money into that area to create his own organizations. Soros and Ford Foundation and other people are pumping millions and millions of dollars into our community now, turning people into Democrats, running against symptoms, to get people run against symptoms so people cannot get to the essence of the question. This is the part of the contest that we're involved in. All of us are involved in this contest. Women's March, you know, that you see happening. All of a sudden, women. This is the Democratic Party fighting to reassert itself in the political life and to regain everything that they lost with I'm with Hillary and et cetera, et cetera. And that's not just the Women's March, there are other factors, other things that we talked about earlier. It's the Democratic Party in motion trying to rescue itself from this situation. But guess what? During that election, you had a situation, the most unpopular presidential candidates in the history, with Trump polling negative 60%, Hillary close to that, 100 million people not voting at all. And yet, people act like the big contest is between the Democrats and Republicans. I'm saying the big contest is between us and all those other people who are not participating at all, and then some of the people who are participating because they don't see any other answers, because people are too cowardly to give another answer. If they're not, they'd rather be in the pockets of Soros or somebody else, as opposed to winning our own communities to the struggle for liberation and winning white people to the position of unity through reparations, because white people are going to have to pay reparations. That's the only way that they're going to have to be able to show real solidarity with African people.
That's the voice of Chairman Omali Yeshitele here at the Uhuru House. Let me ask you this, because we're in the Uhuru House, and this is the last place where Huey Newton gave his last public speech. And you knew him. I remember when he would come down here a lot. In looking back at his legacy, what do you think he would be doing in this moment?
Well, let me say some things. First of all, I love Huey P. Newton. And Huey was an extraordinarily bold person. He was bold intellectually. He was physically courageous. Don't underestimate it. Huey P. Newton was a very courageous person physically. I mean, he'd walk in the middle of a bunch of police, not just with a shotgun, but he'd swing on them. He'd actually have physical confrontation. And he really, at a really important time in our history, when this whole debate was going on around whether or not armed struggle was something that was happening, coming out of the SNCC process and et cetera, Huey answered the question quite emphatically, you know, with the Black rise of the Black Panther Party, where he got from the heart of our communities. These were the working class people living in housing projects, and he was responsible for a rapid radicalization of thousands and millions of African people. Nobody did that, no matter what else. And then Huey, because the Panthers at that time were, they represented the real revolutionary center in this country. I was not a Panther. I was a member of another organization that had some disagreements with the Black Panther Party. But even so, we recognized that the revolutionary center in this country was the Black Panther Party, and in much of the world, for that matter. And because the people around the world looked to black people in this country to make the difference because of what this country was doing to everybody else around the world. So that was a critical question. And Huey P. Newton was responsible for a lot of that. So you cannot underestimate his role in history. Now, when the destruction of the Black Liberation Movement happened, it happened all around him. He became increasingly isolated in the whole world. People remember Huey's isolation because he was in the penthouse, et cetera, but that isolation was bigger than him being in a penthouse. He was driven to a penthouse in many ways because the isolation that was being imposed on our communities and splits, and the more FBI, CIA, military intelligence organizations, and in Oakland, it was the headquarters of all these intelligence things that was happening in the country. It was headquartered in Oakland, directed at Huey P. Newton, directed at the Black Panther Party. So he was isolated. And so Huey fell victim to, over a period of time, when Huey was here I guess it was 87 the last time, he talked about having been arrested at least twice a year for 22 years, you know, something to that effect. I mean, for many, many years, he was just constantly, consistently being arrested and et cetera, and isolated. And snitches, agents. And remember, it was an agent that killed Fred and that set up Fred Hampton. And this is the kind of thing. So Huey fell victim to what many of our people had fallen victim to. And as long as the Panthers movement was relatively strong, Huey was okay, but he got isolated. And so, you know, again, he, you know, fell into a lot of the social contradictions that was destroying our community, and he died like that. We really worked at trying to get Huey back into political life in a good way. And in fact, his brother, you know, after Huey was killed, you know, he expressed appreciation to me for having trying to bring Huey back into political life. So we loved Huey P. Newton. The first attempt on his life was he ended up in a hospital with a severe intestinal problem. And at first they took him to Kaiser. Kaiser opened him up, closed him up, and sent him straight to Highland. And I believe that Kaiser sent him to Highland because they didn't want to take responsibility of what the hell it was they saw and sent him to Highland. And I was with Huey. Every day I was there with Huey and with Frederica, his wife, and what have you. And I think that was the first time that they actually tried to take his life. And then what you saw after that, increasingly, police were arresting Huey. You may remember they arrested Huey in West Oakland because they said his brother's car, which was 6 or 7 blocks away, had a gun in it, and it was Huey's driving the car. He wasn't in the car, you know, and so they arrested him for that. They arrested him. They raided his house. They said they found a gun that wasn't even, it was inoperable, but they found the gun. So they were constantly working Huey, and I believe they were working Huey to make sure that they could catch him unarmed, because the last time, the most important time in Huey P. Newton's life, when they caught him and he had a gun, you know, it changed what the outcome would have been.
And, you know, they neglect to talk about the brutality of that police officer, I'm going to remember his name, that was shot, Fry, that he was a beast, and had been constantly brutalizing folks. So they make it sound like he was just this, you know, but, you know, there's a whole history. You can read that in, you know, the Black to the Empire and all that, because they detail that. Let me ask this, because we're running out of time, and I'm going to give you maybe a couple of minutes to see it. Without revealing the plot to the movie Panther, you know, we were talking off air about this. What is the relationship with black people and the CIA that people should always keep in mind? If you can answer, what does the CIA mean to our community?
The CIA is an enemy to African people, and I could say that and partially because the CIA is an instrument of colonial state power. Its responsibility is to maintain the status quo. That is, the relationships of power as they exist in the world. They killed Lumumba. They captured and killed
Lumumba, for people who don't know,
Patrice Lumumba from Congo. They murdered him. They tracked him down with the Belgians and the French. They called him the Barracuda. They tracked him down. They murdered him.
They're admitting to that. They didn't initially.
Yeah, he was an extraordinary leader, one of the best, you know, that we produced. They killed him. They wounded, captured, and murdered Che Guevara in 1967, October 9th in Bolivia. They have been responsible for disrupting any struggle that we have made to try to win our freedom.
The CIA and crack?
The CIA was responsible for crack. When they first introduced this young brother, Ricky Ross, to cocaine, he had never seen cocaine in his life. Do you understand? This is the guy who they credit with spreading cocaine throughout the... He had never seen cocaine in his life before the CIA. And guess what? He didn't get cocaine. He got something that was produced in a laboratory that is a derivative of cocaine, this insidious thing that was called crack. And so the CIA has played a horrible role and continues to play, not only with us, but peoples all around the world. They overthrew Mossadegh in Iran. They're still fighting that as a consequence of that. In 1954, they overthrew Abin in Guatemala, I think it was, in 1954-55. They have wreaked havoc all around the world, and they continue to do it at this very moment. So the CIA is not a friend of our people, and that's something that surely should be understood.
Well, we appreciate that. Now, I wanted to put that out there so we can kind of, you know, always take advantage and give people food for thought.
May I say one other thing? A thing that I'm concerned about is we are not going to be freed by a superhero organization. That's what the Panthers, they weren't looking for superheroes organizations. That's what the Panthers, this was JOMO, that's African People's Socialist Party. That's how they destroy the organizations and the heads of those organizations in order to make the organization ineffective. And I just want to really help people to understand that we will not be freed by a superhero. We will win our liberation as a consequence of the people participating in the organization.
There you have it. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. That is Chairman Omali Isitelli. I want to thank you for being our guest. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
I was born in Louisiana, Pops was a minister. Six brothers and sisters, show on Benjamin's. Moved out to Oakland, but my life's still sinister. 14, pistol possession and vandalism. I graduated high school, still couldn't read, though. Teachers wasn't nothing but a bump to my speed, though. I'm self-taught, went to college and a law school. Studying the system and steady feeding me dog food. Every other week, cops crack a head open and make you want to load the lead and leave a pig smoking. Politicians talking, but they be sugarcoating. I know the penal codes, let's put this thing in motion. So you can carry loaded weapons if they ain't concealed. It started out, couple homies, me and Bobby Seale. Until they witnessed the Panthers and knew that we was real. Real. We ain't the only ones, tired of ones getting killed. Ride through the streets, and we mob deep, deep. See a cop jack a brother make his heart beat, beat. We hop out, guns out like an army. And this was the birth of the Black Panther Party. We tell the brother chill, if brother don't resist, give him your name and ask him if you under arrest. And if you are, we'll follow you and bail you out. The next day, everybody had us in their mouth. Walk like a talk, like a stalk, like a panther. Ride like a glide, like a fight, like a panther. Do the grown man when I dance like a panther. Ain't much scary to a revolutionary. Cause I walk like a talk, like a stalk, like a panther. Ride like a glide, like a fight, like a panther. Do the grown man when I dance like a panther.
In America, black people are treated very much as the Vietnamese people or any other colonized people, because we're used, we're brutalized. The police in our community occupy our area, our community, as a foreign troop occupies territory. And the police are there not to, in our community, not to promote our welfare or for our security and our safety, but they're there to contain us, to brutalize us and murder us, because they have their orders to do so. And just as the soldiers in Vietnam have their orders to destroy the Vietnamese people, the police in our community couldn't possibly be there to protect our property, because we own no property. They couldn't possibly be there to see that we receive the due process of law, for the simple reason that the police themselves deny us the due process of law. And so it's very apparent that the police are only in our community, not for our security, but the security of the business owners in the community, and also to see that the status quo is kept intact. When we first started, we had a police alert patrol, and we would patrol the community. If we saw the police brutalize anyone, we would put an end to this. Usually the police wouldn't brutalize anyone if we were on hand, because we were armed, and if the police arrested the individual, we would follow him to the jail and bail the individual out, whether he was a Panther or not. And we would gain many recruits like this. So therefore the community started to say that, well, these people are really concerned about our welfare. We feel that the white students should relate and pay more attention to the colonized situation here of the blacks first, because after all, this is home. And they should. This is not to say that they shouldn't denounce America's treacherous actions abroad. I think they can be done at the same time. That it's just a matter of placing emphasis upon the criminal activities of America here in the homeland.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D.
Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah.
Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy, though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Nine Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat to the belly from the steel grave. I'll save you a seat at the table with a great red making a speech. Say some peace to the lovers I made with a breeze. Made a stone shade on your name in the street. You go, hey, it ain't David D.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Radio. ours. It will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day when the war is won, we will be sure.
The heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtapositioning us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be now the war is not over, victory isn't won, but we'll fight on to the finish, and then when it's all done, we'll cry glory, oh glory, oh, oh.
Selma is now for every man, woman, and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. No one can win a war individually. It take the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory. The coming of the Lord, my eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh,
I'd like you to meet a friend of ours who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat
standing on a corner in a neatly pressed double-breasted form-fitting pinstripe suit, a pair of pointed-toed shoes with bold white stitches around the soles, a black shirt, long white tie, a black pencil mustache, and of course, a very wide-brimmed black felt hat. Killer Joe always has a pocket full of loot, but only the kind that jingles. You see, he likes to play the horses. He is most certainly a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he is always willing to accept cash contributions from them for any cause, namely his own. The most important thing about Killer Joe that you have to know is that he's very much against manual labor. Killer Joe.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. During this pandemic, KBOO is still here to serve the community, and we need you to be there for us. If you're able, please go to KBOO.